which are transient ischemic attacks that are tiny little strokes. So something's up with my blood, but I don't know what it is.
Did the experience change anything for you? Like, did it change sort of the way you looked at life or work or anything?
I think unconsciously, yeah. I mean, it was terrifying. It was really scary. And I didn't change anything dramatically, you know, in my life, but I guess it sounds cheesy to say, but I think I always am aware of how precious life is, and I try to remember that every day. And I'm sure that has something to do with my approach and my attitude about, you know, about everything. I tend to see the bigger picture, and or try to see the bigger picture, and try not to take things so seriously, and try not to get hung up on the small things. And but I just I can't help but think that it has affected me in ways that I won't even know until later. But I do have a overall feeling of life is short, and I might as well just do as much as I can. Maybe it's why I'm so busy.
Aubrey Plaza, thank you so much for coming on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Actress Aubrey Plaza spoke with Fresh Air producer Anne Marie Baldonado. If you'd like to catch up with interviews you missed with Howard Markel about the Kellogg brothers of Battle Creek, Michigan, who were pioneers in wellness, or our archive interview with Glenn Campbell, check out our podcast, where you'll find those and many other interviews. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaini, and Thea Challoner. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Home Advisor, matching homeowners with background-checked professionals for a variety of home projects, from minor repairs to major remodels. Homeowners can read reviews, compare prices, and book appointments online at homeadvisor.com. And from Whole Foods Market, offering lunchbox staples geared to children, including sandwich and snack ideas using natural and organic ingredients. A variety of back-to-school items are available at Whole Foods Market. We believe in real food.
Senator Bernie Sanders says the time is right for a single-payer health care system.
I think we've got to join the rest of the industrialized world and guarantee health care to all people as a right, not a privilege.
But many Democratic leaders disagree.
The comfort level with a broader base of the American people is not there yet.
I'm Ari Shapiro, the Democrats and single payer, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen today at 4 on KTOO Juno.
Humpback whales can make a big splash, so for your own safety and because it's the law, NOAA Fisheries reminds you to keep your distance from these marine mammals. Federal law prohibits pursuit or approach within 100 yards or placing your vessel in the path of oncoming humpback whales. Boaters must operate at a slow, safe speed, limit time with whales to 30 minutes or less, and avoid approaching when other vessels are near. To report a violation, call NOAA Law Enforcement at 800-853-1964.
Tune for a Juno afternoon. We'll talk with landscaper Dave Lindrum about plying his art at UAS. We'll also talk with folks involved with some changes at Capital Transit. Sally Schlichting will be here to highlight the upcoming Conbrio concert series, and Nancy DeCherney will be here with Arts Up. That Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. Taking a look at the weather for the rest of today, mostly sunny, but tonight changing to mostly cloudy. Tomorrow there is a chance of rain, highs in the mid-60s. By Friday night, rain is more likely with lows in the 50s, and by Saturday, there will be rain. Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Authorities have named a suspect in last week's triple murder on the Crow Nation in Montana. Indian Country Today Media Network reports police and the FBI are seeking to question 32-year-old Roderick Plentyhawk after three people were killed and two injured in a meth-related shooting in the town of Lodgegrass. A federal court has overturned a Muscogee Creek man's death sentence in a major jurisdiction ruling. The ruling reaffirms the tribe's historical reservation boundaries in Oklahoma. The case goes back to 1999, when Patrick Murphy was accused of murdering another Muscogee man. He was convicted in Oklahoma court and put on death row in 2000. Sarah Deer is a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma and a former law professor. She says Tuesday's 10th Circuit Court of Appeals ruling agrees with Murphy that the tribe and federal government, not the state, should have jurisdiction in his case.
He said, "I was within the Creek Reservation when I committed this crime, and therefore the state of Oklahoma does not have the authority to prosecute me."
The court's acknowledgement of the reservation is significant because most of the tribal lands in Oklahoma today are no longer known as reservations. That's because in 1901, the federal government broke up the reservations into individual allotments. Deer says at that point, lots of people started operating under the assumption that the Creek Reservation no longer existed.
But in today's understanding of what that requires, Congress had to both allot the land and declare the reservation non-existent. They didn't do part two, and that's why the court concludes here that the Creek Reservation has never been demolished or even diminished in any way.
Deer says, though it might seem odd to be cheering a decision that could release a murderer, she's celebrating the ruling that the Creek Nation maintains authority over their reservation land.
It's going to influence, I think, decisions about litigation across the country for Indian tribes.
If the state of Oklahoma doesn't appeal this week's decision, a federal prosecutor could decide to retry Patrick Murphy. An Athabascan artist is reviving the tradition of making baskets from fish skin. Sarah Gibson visited the artist's class in Sitka, Alaska.
Audrey Armstrong is reaching into a cooler of gleaming fish skins, lingcod, salmon, and halibut. They look and feel like soft leather, scales still on, scraped clean of flesh.
Look at that.
But then Armstrong finds one with a trace of meat still attached. She holds it up for the class to see.
You do not want to ever save skins like this. All that meat on it right now and fat, it's just going to rot in your work. So you got to totally like scrape, scrape, scrape. A lot of scraping.
And she means a lot. Making a basket can take hours, even days of scraping meat from the skin. Armstrong begins. Once the fish skins are clean, you cut and sew them together. Then you dry the basket around a mold and decorate it. When she started basketry, Armstrong had to improvise. She didn't have a teacher or a book, just stories from her auntie about how the village used fish skins centuries ago. Armstrong tells her class how she got started. She was fly fishing, she caught a salmon, and she had this moment.
And the sun just started coming out, and it had these beautiful colors in the salmon, purples, pinks, and I looked at it and I said, wow, my ancestors used to make things out of fish skin, but I've never seen anything made out of it.
So Armstrong got to work, scraping the skins and experimenting. When she finished her first basket, she brought it to her auntie. Even though they knew stories of these baskets, Armstrong's was the first Athabascan fish skin basket either had ever seen or touched.
And she goes, "Ani," which in my Athabascan language means very good. And that just warmed my heart because then I knew I was on the right path.
I'm Sarah Gibson in Sitka, Alaska.
And I'm Hannah Colton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
And by Humboldt State University, we know what it means to be rooted in community. You can get your Master's of Social Work and amplify your voice without having to leave it. The part-time online program accepts applications between August 1st and 31st. More at humboldt.edu/socialwork. Support by BNSF Railway. Proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd. Helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribal relations.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Laurie Scandling, this afternoon's volunteer host. And with me, of course, is our producer, Jeff Brown. Thank you, as always, Jeff. My first guest this afternoon is Dave Lindrum. He has, for 20 years, been the landscape supervisor at the University of Alaska Southeast campuses. There are three, of course, one in Juneau, another in Sitka, and another in Ketchikan. Welcome, Dave. Glad to have you.
Thanks a lot, Laurie.
Just our precursor conversation, I found really interesting. You use the term that landscape is a language and that it tells you how to behave.
Oh, it does. It's really an introduction for almost any outdoor space. When you come to some location, you come to a ferry terminal, you come to somebody's office, you go to their house, you go to a church. You don't look for printed signs. You look for the obvious landscape clues that tell you where to go, how to stand, where's the door, is this a public space, is this a private space, is this a semi-private space, is this an intimate space, are you invited here, should you not be here? You know, all those things are clues given to you for how to act in the public spaces, in the outdoor spaces. And so In a large public institution like the university, there are lots and lots of spaces. And that's one of my jobs, is to make them all not only thrive and be successful and attractive, but to guide people into where they're – how do you get to a place? You know, wayfinding is not just looking at maps. We knew how to get to places long time before we had maps and long time before the buildings had names on them. You know, we were able to make our way around different kinds of places. So that's one of the things that I mean when I say landscape is a language. And it's not just for public spaces. You know, it's the same thing in someone's private yard. You know, the layout of your vegetable garden area is really different than where your kids are going to play soccer. And if you have a collection of rhododendrons in your yard, it's not the same place that you throw your tennis ball for the dog to run. And all that stuff kind of fits in when somebody talks to you about landscape design. They're not just talking about what colors are going to be in the yard. It really has to do with outdoor space organization.
You talked about UAS campus in particular being a laboratory of sort and the commitment to not throw anything away. In fact, you said if we dig a hole, we save the dirt. So tell me more.
Okay, so the last big hole we dug was the John Pugh freshman dorm. And that had it had great big trees on it, which I can't really transplant, you know. But underneath that, there was a layer of smaller shrubbery, and we saved as much of that as we could. And the next layer down is the peaty kind of soil surface, and we saved that and put it in a pile. And then below that is the mineral kind of soil, and we save that and put it in another pile because there, all these things are things you're going to have to use again. And rather than buy them again, you know, we have them in hand. So then when we finished that development and it was time to re-landscape it, we're able to use the subsoils we have stashed and the sands and gravels we have stashed. And part of the excavation was blasting away a big stone formation. So that was it was probably a month with big excavators and rock hammers breaking them apart, and all those boulders were reused into the landscape in various places. And then a lot of the plant material was put back into that landscape, and actually that landscape was almost entirely made with stuff that I took from various parts of the campus that were being redeveloped over the last couple of years. So we had 60 or 80-year-old rhododendrons that we were able to dig up from where they were going to be run over, where our new parking lot was going to be, and put them aside for a while and did that time, you know, bring them back to maximum health, prune them to shape. And so by the time we put them back into the landscape, they're thriving. And the same thing with a lot of the ground covers and the native plant material. And now we're doing another project starting next week. And it's going to be almost entirely vegetated with stuff that we've used from other parts of the campus. And you've probably noticed that big concrete wall going in along there. And, you know, everything's changing. The road moved into the campus. The old driveway going up into the facility services has vanished. And so any sense that people could come through that area and make their way out to the road is now gone. So all that stuff has to be rearranged too.
You mentioned it as a laboratory. How do you mean that, as a laboratory?
Well, lots of the stuff we'd never seen it done before. You know, the idea that you can peel up the native landscape like it's fudge and move it around and rearrange it is something that has been developed here in Southeast Alaska. Luckily, I'm married to a landscape architect whose life work was that. But I've really taken a lot of the clues there. And so we've worked with that sense, and also with the sense that if you want to have a landscape that the university has to pay for maintenance. It's not like in your front yard where you can go out and take care of it or not according to how you want. You know, it has to look good, and we have to pay for it. So design tells you where it's going to be hard, where it's going to be easy, how to make it as easy as possible. And one of the clues here is the low-maintenance mantra for Southeast Alaska is no bare earth. If you can see the ground, it's going to be filled with weeds. So one of the things that I've worked at over the years was developing a palette of plant material that we can put in place. And once it's established, it meets together over the top and the ground vanishes. And so maybe there might be some weeds down there. There might even be an empty coffee cup or something. But if you can't see it, it essentially doesn't exist for you. And the inspiration for that is Eagle Crest. If you look at the woods in Eagle Crest and look at the landscape there, you'll see that the visual plane is not the ground. The visual plane is about 2 feet up. It's where the blueberries are, you know, and that's what you see. So if you can duplicate that in a domestic landscape or a commercial or institutional landscape, that's the clue to be able to do that. And then we tried other things too. And one of the most interesting ones is that there's a recreational facility that is a joint use facility with the National Guard. And it's off the new entrance to the university is on the back loop road. And the other way at that intersection leads you back up to the recreation center. So when that road was blasted, the architect's plans called for spraying grass along the side of the roads, like almost all new roads get. Excuse me. So when you have grass by the side of the road, it means somebody's got to manage it and weed eat it or mow it or do something like that so it stays looking, you know, domestic.
Presentable.
Yeah.
Domestic. There's a good word.
So what happens if you don't is it all goes to alders. And we've thought of how to work with alders over the years. And the very first time we did it was at the fish hatchery. And there's a hedge at the parking lot there that is trimmed alder. And it's been there since the hatchery opened.
I didn't know it was alder.
Well, there you look at it. And so we did the same thing along the access road. And if you want to see a real low-maintenance landscape on a large scale, there's a great one. It's really meant to be seen at 15, 20 miles an hour, you know, as you drive along. But the alder has been hedged and kept at 3 feet. So from the very beginning. You can't take big alders and make it go back. But you start with little alders and keep them so that they're 3, 3.5 feet, and then every year you prune the new growth back to that spot. It stays real dense. It's low nitrogen fixing. You know, alders feed themselves, and there's not much in the way of predation. There's no bugs that really bother them. They don't get diseases here. It's an ideal solution to that, and once a year somebody has to prune it. So that's been a pretty useful
thing. Cost-efficient as well.
Cost-efficient. A very attractive. It does require somebody has to do it, you know, and I'm lucky enough that I have an associate at the university who's pretty enthusiastic about that stuff. Ray Roberts and his maintenance crew have kept on top of that for years. So every year there's a new crew. Ray trains them how to work, you know, shows them the tasks, and we work through all that stuff together.
You mentioned that you felt it would be important to invite the public out to look at the collections and some of the techniques that you've developed in your 20-year tenure at the university. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about? And what other collections would you like the public to see?
Oh, I'd love for them to come and see. There's some absolutely marvelous stuff out there. And some of them are things that we only tried there first. Other things are ones that we've seen in other places around town and realized how nice they were. There's a new kind of hydrangea. Hydrangeas are real hip these days. And there's that kind that has a ball-shaped flower about the size of my head. That's the one that most people know. And they grow here, but they don't really bloom very well. But there's another species that has flowers that look kind of like lilacs. Mm. They're a long, pointy cone. And in that kind, there's a lot of plant breeding interest. And one of the most exciting ones is called Hydrangea quickfire. And quickfire is a real tough shrub. It's a zone 2 plant, so it's hardy to minus 50. It doesn't even show leaves on it until the end of May, maybe the beginning of June some years. And it's just now starting to flower. And the flowers come in a foot to 2 foot long cone.
Whoa.
And they open in a pale green. And as they ripen, they get pinker and rose and then red and then deep red. And by the time the snow falls, they're still in bloom, and they have red flowers with burgundy leaves on them by then. It's such a beautiful, beautiful
shrub. What a showgirl.
Yeah, and stands up to the weather. So the rain can beat on it like mad, doesn't faze it at all. And the bears don't eat it, which is, you know, that's a big deal.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dave Lindrum. He is a landscaper and for 20 years has been doing that job at UAS. Would you describe your job as art?
Oh, absolutely. Art, science, politics, technology, all that stuff, you know, and romance, you know, and communication, you know, because like I say, it is a language, but if people don't speak the language, it's hard for them to see it. I've had the opportunity several times to have classes from the university where their instructor will say, you know, take them around and show them. And most, you know, what can you say? Most young people have never seen what's going on around them. They missed that lesson of what's happening in the landscape. So if I can show them, oh, the difference between a rose bush that has roses on the new growth and a rose bush that has roses on last year's growth. You know, there's a window of opportunity to see something. And, you know, so what that means is that someday they may have a rose bush. They may not, but probably they will.
Do you lead tours for the public ever? If somebody,
absolutely, I do.
How would somebody reach you to walk around with you?
They just contact my office through the facilities services. I'm available at an email address,
okay.
dwlendrum@alaska.edu.
And that's L-E-N-D-R-U-M?
Absolutely right, Lori.
dwlendrum@alaska.edu. So if you would like a walk around that laboratory that conveys romance, beauty, art, science, and politics.
And communication.
Contact Dave Lindrum. Thanks for joining me today.
Okay, Lori. Thanks again.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 10th of August, 2017. It's the birthday of the poet Lawrence Binyon, born Lancaster, England, 1869, best known for his poem For the Fallen, which he wrote to honor First World War dead, which includes the lines, "They shall grow not old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them." It was on this date, 1846, the U.S. Congress passed legislation creating the Smithsonian Institution. James Smithson was an English scientist, the illegitimate son of a nobleman and a widow related to the royal family, born in secret in Paris, never married, spent his life traveling, getting to know great scientific minds, and shortly before he died in 1829, he bequeathed his estate to his nephew. But if the nephew died childless, Smithson wrote, then the money was to go to the United States for the foundation of an institution for the increase and diffusion of knowledge. The nephew died without heirs, and so the money came here. There was a big debate about the Smithsonian. The Federalists were in favor of it. The supporters of states' rights argued the Constitution didn't make any provisions for a national institution, but the Federalists won out. And then people argued about what Smithson meant by the phrase increase and diffusion of knowledge. Did he mean a research institute, an observatory, publishing house, library, museum, or what? And in the end, it became all of those things. Smithsonian includes museums of natural history, American history, fine and decorative arts, air and space technology, 16 museums in all, plus the National Zoo. And it was on this date in 1519 that Ferdinand Magellan set off to sail around the world. He left with a fleet of 5 ships and 270 men, left from Seville, heading west, crossed the Atlantic, sailed around South America through what later came to be called the Strait of Magellan, became the first European to enter the Pacific Ocean from the east, and he gave it its name, Pacific, because it was much calmer than the Atlantic. The fleet stopped off in what are now called the Philippine Islands, where Magellan got killed in a battle, April 1521. The remaining fleet went on without him, got back to Seville, 1 ship and 18 men, in September 1522. Here's a poem for today by John Daniel, After the Wedding, for Marilyn. After the white balloons were swept away on the wind that had swallowed most of our vows, after the embraces and tears, the flung rose petals, after new friends and old friends and aunts from everywhere, after you tossed the bouquet and the cries of the children raised coyote cries on the rim, after chicken grilled on juniper coals, cold beer from the cattle trough, and hours of hot dancing to Beatles and Stones, the last of us swaying, arms on shoulders, singing ourselves hoarse. How good it is to find you now, beyond all the loud joy, driving north in rain and the lovely ease of our silence. After the Wedding, a poem by John Daniel from Common Ground, published by Confluence Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes Store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
In Southeast, children learn about culture and tradition by watching those in action. Dancing, drumming, fishing, and harvesting teach healthy behaviors for future generations. Tobacco is not part of our culture. Don't let it be part of yours. For free support quitting, contact Alaska's Tobacco Quitline at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or alaskaquitline.com. This message is brought to you by the Partnership for a Tobacco-Free Southeast and Search.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Laurie Scandling. It's about 24 minutes after the hour. With me now are Denise Guzzio, who has been with Capital Transit for 11 years as the admin assistant, and also Sergei Niehaus, who is the recently appointed operations supervisor for Capital Transit, and he's been there for 10 years. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. So, Denise, you were saying there are going to be some customer service-related upgrades and changes related to technology. Please tell us about that.
Well, we've made some, already made some of those changes over the last year or so. We did some rebranding of the vehicles and the uniforms. So we upgrade, you know, have some new uniforms, and a lot of the customers may have noted our new vehicles that are on the road with the new paint scheme and our new logo. And we upgraded the bus stop signs around town. And we have rolled out a new website for Capital Transit that has our new rider's guide schedules on it. And we have come up with new real-time apps for our customers. A Transit app is a new app that we have available, and we also have a Swiftly app that people have been using for a while. And so those are some of the customer service upgrades that we've made. So we're continuing to improve on those.
What was the point of the rebranding? It's a small town. Everybody knows what Capital Transit is. I'm curious about the redoing of the bus stop signs and of the buses themselves. What was the thinking there?
Well, we've been Capital Transit's had the same design for quite a few years, and we thought that we wanted to kind of get a new look out there, to get a fresh new look for Capital Transit and kind of put a new spin on what people have kind of seen as our kind of the same look that we've had for a long time. So we decided to go with a new logo. The city and borough went with a new logo that they've had for a long time, and we wanted to kind of put a new logo out there and new colors and a new look, and we were ordering new buses, so we decided to go with that. The bus stop signs, is that what you asked me the second question?
Just,
the bus stop signs, it all kind of ties together. If you notice the bus stop signs around town, they have the new look, but they also have bus stop numbers. And those bus stop numbers really tie to everything. Those they tie to the apps and the website. And people have really utilized those in a positive way, because often if you're at the bus stop sign, they'll call me at Transit, say, I'm at bus stop 401, and I can tell exactly where you're at. If you're at a stop, you know, before they would say, I'm here at Glacier Highway. Well, Glacier Highway is a long stretch of road, and I would go, well, look around. Do you see any major buildings?
Landmarks.
Yeah.
Where are you?
Are you near Fred Meyer's? Do you see a building? You know, anything? And I would try to guess where they're at. But now if they tell me that bus number, I can know exactly where they're at. And also, we're on Google Transit now. So if you have a smartphone or you're in a computer, you can go to Google Maps and look at the icon and either do a street view, which will actually show you an actual photo picture, street view picture of the bus stop, and it will give you that the bus stop number.
Much more specific than for those who are trying to figure out, you know, is this particular bus late, or am I taking the right bus, or what is the route of this bus, which could be confusing. And a lot of visitors seem to use our public buses as well. I see folks going to the Glacier by getting off at the nearest bus stop there and then walking the rest of the way. So.
Yeah, and with our new website, we're getting a lot more demographic information. Like, we were just looking at some information for our new website, so we can tell what kind of visitor information are coming to our website, like people from Japan and Korea and Italy and other visitors from all over the world are visiting our website. And that is information that we couldn't really get before. And now we can kind of see who is visiting our website and what pages they're looking at and how long they're spending there. And so we can use that information to kind of gear the information we put on our website to improve our customer service.
Great. Sergey, how does that translate into changes in operations?
Well, with operations, for us on the other end,
not out in a bus, like she was mentioning. When we get phone calls, we can give information in a timely manner without having to and taking out the guesswork. So for me, I'm running my live, real-time website all day long. So when someone calls, I can give them, hey, the bus is at so-and-so. Or due to construction, this bus is running 10 minutes late. So for our operations on our end, it just makes things run smoother.
Have there been any significant changes in the routes in Juneau based on, say, feedback from your consumer base?
Well, here recently, within the last few years, we have added service up into the Diamond Park area and Riverside. And service is slowly picking up. The numbers are gaining as people are learning this just by word of mouth. So, yeah, definitely.
And are there other areas of the community that you as operations manager understand may be underserved and would like to expand, but for some reason you cannot? Meaning, how do you roll out a planning process to know where else the Capital Transit system might need to go? What tools do you use to evaluate?
And you may be able to help me with this, Denise. Every so many years we go through a transit development plan. And within that transit development plan, we are given recommendations on whether it's added service or a multitude of things. And within that transit development plan, yeah, there are areas that could see some more utilization that are recommended.
Anything specific coming up that you're aware of that for which there's seeming to be some increased demand?
There always usually is, a need for or a want for wanting to go into different areas. It's just kind of weighing that want or need to fitting it in with, does it fit in with the ability to change our route in a, because the way that the, that our geographically set, our city is set out, being able to make a route that's feasible to have it go into that area, like, the need to go into Costco area or need to go to the ferry terminal. The ferry comes in this many times, once every 3 hours. Well, to change a route to go out to the ferry terminal once every 3 hours is not economically maybe feasible to do that when you have to change a whole route to go out there. So you kind of have to weigh that, the pros and cons of that.
You know, you mentioned new buses. Is it because there's better technology to run buses now, or was it the other ones were just on their last legs?
It's a useful life. It's 12 years or so many thousand miles. I think it's 500,000 miles.
Yeah. Did you say 500,000
miles? 500,000 miles, yeah.
That's a lot of miles.
Yeah. And so we received grants to replace 4 buses, and then we received a grant to replace 3 more buses. And then so now we're going to replace 4 more.
What's your total fleet, Sergey?
We have 18 buses.
And I would assume not all 18 are running at the same time, or would I be wrong about that?
Not all 18 are running at the same time. Mornings are our peak times where we have the most amount of buses out there due to our morning commuter buses getting the people of Juneau to work on time. So we have, that's when we have the most amount of buses on the road at any given time, and that could be up to 12 buses.
What's your average daily ridership on a work day? Any ideas?
I don't know about daily. The we provide about 1 million rides a year. A little over 1 million rides a year.
And you mentioned expansion of routes and other considerations as to whether they're economically feasible. Do the fares support the bus system, or is this also a municipally operated system?
The fares do not support the bus system.
Also have a city budget,
by the city property tax funds.
And what is the website that folks can go to look at the schedules and get some more information about the apps that they can use as they're standing out there in the Now, now they don't have to be in the rain at every bus stop. There are many more bus stops than there used to be. But where would you advise your riders to go to learn more?
They can go to JunoCapitalTransit.org.
And you mentioned the two or three apps. Why didn't you mention those again, Denise?
Transit app is one app, and it's got a green icon with a little white kind of squiggly line through it if you're looking on Android or Apple app. And then Swiftly is the other one.
And you said that Google Transit will also show the actual bus stop number and some of that data to more specifically help people find out where to catch that bus.
Yeah, if you go to Google Maps and you put in an address, it'll bring up the map of that area. And if you kind of scroll into it, it'll show our bus stops will show up as little blue and white bus stop icons.
Great.
And then you can go to the satellite view and it'll actually bring up the picture of our bus stop.
Making getting around easier in Juneau. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank
you. You're welcome.
This is Bird Note.
Into the smoky morning, I'm trudging down the line. Past the dirty, tangy engine, going to the mine.
For at least 75 years, miners in Great Britain carried a live canary in a cage every day as they went down into the mines. So, how did this practice start? Miners began using canaries in 1911, based on the advice of Scottish scientist John Haldane. He reasoned that a singing bird would be a good indicator of carbon monoxide. The gas can build to deadly levels in mines, and it has no smell. When a canary began to weaken or stopped singing, miners knew to get out of the mine, and quickly. But why use a bird as an alarm instead of, say, a mouse? Haldane understood a bird's breathing anatomy, and he knew that as birds breathe, they get a dose of air both as they inhale and as they exhale. Compared to mice or to miners, canaries would get a double dose of toxic gases. Their reaction served as an early warning of danger. The little birds with the big song served alongside British miners until 1986, when more humane electronic warning devices replaced them. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
One day I'll be flying to from going to the mine.
And welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. With me now are Sally Schlichting. She is the producer of a concert that will be happening on Saturday afternoon called the Conbrio Chamber Series, and it's featuring two Juneau artists, violinist Lisa Ibias, who's also here, welcome, as well as pianist Sue Kazama. What does Conbrio mean, Sally?
Well, Conbrio means with spirit, with life, and I wanted to create this series of chamber music concerts to enrich Juneau audiences and to give local musicians the opportunity to share their art with the community. So this season is a series of six concerts, which is it's really exciting. We have a program with a climate change activist and a pianist. We have a flute quartet. We have a singer and strings in the fall with flute and clarinet. And then we have a real interesting program in January with Lisa again and myself and Kayagum, which is a Korean zither and percussion. So that'll be an interesting program. And then we'll have a program of minimalism in February, which if you don't know what minimalism is, you'll have to come to the concert and find out. So they were opening this season with this recital of Lisa Ibias, violinist, and Sue Kazama this Saturday at 2 o'clock at the atrium. And if you want a schedule of the concerts, come to the concert on Saturday. So.
And when you say the atrium, you mean next door at the Andrew P. Kashevaroff?
That's correct. Thank
you. Alaska State Library Museum and Archives.
Yes.
I hear that the setting is really fantastic there.
It is. It's beautiful. It's a wonderful space to perform in. Musicians love it as well as the audience. And there's seating for about 75 to 80 people. And we're really pleased to have the support of the Friends of the State Library, Archives, and Museum to put on this concert.
So this is the first of a six-part series of Combrio, is that right?
That's correct.
And it sounds like each one will be at a different location?
There's a lot of different locations. I think the next concert will be at the Northern Light Church. That's A Call to Life, Variations on a Theme of Extinction. And then Flutatious is performing here at 360 in November, and also at Aldersgate. And so there's a lot of different venues, Aldersgate, Holy Trinity.
So it'll be around town at a variety of places.
Yeah.
And this Saturday's performance is at 2 at the atrium, as you said. And what is the cost?
The cost is free. We're just taking donations to cover our expenses and help support future music programs there. So.
Excellent. Lisa, how did you and Sue Kazama, who will be your partner pianist, how do you decide what it is that will be part of the program? If each program has a theme, as it sounds like it does, how do you come together and decide what it is you're going to play?
Well, you know, we've been performing together for many, many, many years. And, you know, some of the pieces are stuff that we've already performed before. And then I usually bring a piece to Sue and Skoes and ask her, do you want to play this? And she either says yay or nay.
Pretty straightforward.
Yeah. We just, you know, we pull together things that we like to play. I mean, we didn't really have a name or anything. So
I should mention that Lisa has been concertmaster for 11 years of the Juno Symphony. What does that involve? I've often wondered, because I've seen you stand and at the beginning. What are the tasks?
Yeah, it's
of
more
being,
than just ceremonial.
Right, and wearing generally a very lovely evening wear of some sort. Yeah. So what are the tasks involved?
Concertmaster has a couple of jobs. A big thing is corralling all the strings. I do a lot of calling people, seeing if they're going to play. I put together, if you see that our bows are all going the same way, that is my work. I put together all the bowings. I help the other players get their parts together. We do sectionals and I lead those. I'm also kind of like I think the big job is that I help I help the conductor, the director,
You interface between the strings and the conductor. So when he asks, like, is this possible, you know, she'll say, well, you know, play it on the string or off the string or, you know.
She's a
translator in a way.
That's
you
it.
Know?
Yeah,
a
kind
liaison.
Of yeah,
she's
translate.
An ambassador
that's
for
it.
The strings.
I translate what he wants to the strings.
Yeah.
And, you know, because sometimes it's not always clear, I mean, to some people, what he's asking for with his stick. And so I help them with that, too.
Yeah, so she's kind of the secondary conductor in a way. So they watch, all the string players watch Lisa like a hawk for cues.
Yeah, where my bow is, what fingerings I'm using, what kind of stroke I'm using. They try and that's kind of whenever I'm sitting in a section, that's who I look at is my section leader to see how they're doing.
Interesting. Sally, was this series your idea?
Yes, it was.
And why? And it sounds like there are some very interesting themes that are laced throughout, some of them environmental. What was your inspiration in putting together a series?
I really love chamber music myself. I have a personal passion, as Lisa knows. And I just wanted to do more of it, whether it was me or other musicians in town. And I saw a need for musicians in town who weren't – maybe I thought they ought to – be out there performing more. I wanted the community to hear some of the incredible talent that we have. And the musicians have come forward and they're loving this idea. So the theme is, you know, the themes of some of these programs are just, I loved how unique they were, a little bit different, something new for the audience to enjoy.
And you mentioned that if folks would like to know specifics about the entire series and where they are and what the themes are to come to the concert. But do you have an online presence where people can also take a look at this information?
I do. Online, I have a Facebook page for the Combrio Chamber Series, and I certainly take phone calls and emails and add people to my distribution list for reminders about the concerts.
But folks can get the details then on Facebook, Combrio,
sure.
C-O-N-B-R-I. Oh.
That's correct. Combrio, chamber,
Combrio.
Series.
What is the definition of chamber music?
It's typically music that's performed in a very small venue, and usually it's a small number of musicians, not like symphonic. You don't have a conductor. You have ensembles of, say, 2, 3, 4, 5 people, maybe more, but usually it's something like that. Would you like to add anything to that?
I think a lot, you know, chamber music is a musician's guilty pleasure. It really is. If you go to a chamber music concert, you know, you can tell that most musicians, you know, the musicians are enjoying it probably even more than the actual audience. You know, to be able to get in that kind of small group is really fun, and it's inspiring, and, you know, it creates like a intimate kind of place for people, and not just the audience, but for the players too.
I mean, it started in living rooms, you know. Yeah. That's the thing. It's just living rooms, you know, playing for each other and reading through piles of quartets or whatever. And it's just fun, you know.
So, Lisa, what are you most looking forward to playing this Saturday? Again, it's at 2 o'clock at the APK Atrium. I see there will be Beethoven, Dvorak. What are you most excited and would most recommend to those who are interested in coming on Saturday?
Well, you know, all of these composers wrote some really great chamber music, and I totally recommend, you know, looking up and listening to some of the Beethoven quartets. And Grieg isn't a well-known composer. I mean, there's the Peer Gynt suites and all that, but I don't think people know a lot about his chamber music. He wrote some amazing string quartets. That's where
beautiful.
I first started listening to him was these string quartets, and I'm like, gosh, I wonder if he wrote anything else for violin. And so I started looking up, and then I found the three sonatas that he wrote, and, you know, fell in love with them because I love his music. And Dvorak as well. I mean, everybody knows him for, you know, his symphony, and everybody knows, you know, the American String Quartet. But I bet you haven't listened to some of his other quartets, which are just awesome. And the Romance was actually written in a quartet that at the time nobody would play. Nobody liked. And so he went and he took it and he put it in, you know, as a solo piece. But I think it is in print now. You can play it or
as a quartet.
Yeah, as a quartet.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool.
So his string quartets are just amazing. You know,
he's a great writer for strings.
Yeah, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I have to say, honestly, I feel the cambrio from each of you. I mean, no, really, the you're both smiling and happy, and I can feel the life just in your excitement about music. And if you would like to share that excitement again, 2 o'clock. On Saturday, the first in a 6-part series called Cambrio Chamber Series. This one, as others, will be free. This one will be at the atrium at the APK, again, 2 o'clock on Saturday. And I'd like to thank Lisa Ibia. She has been the longtime concertmaster and violinist with the Juno Symphony, and Sally Schlichting, who is a flautist with the symphony as well. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you
very much.
Money Laundering 101. Say you come across a suitcase with $5 million in it. You gotta age it up, crumple it, drag it through the dirt. You mix the $5 million with the cash business, and voila, your money.
Thank you.
It's a Juno afternoon. We're about 10 minutes before the hour. And my last guest today is Megan Chambers. She is executive assistant at the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. And today is Thursday. So today is Arts Up. What's up, Megan? We talked about the Cambrillo concert on Saturday, but there's a lot happening Friday and Saturday as
well. There is. Yeah. Always a busy weekend in Juno, even with the good weather. So.
Well, it's about to break down so people can think about all the opportunities that there are to do this weekend without feeling like they're missing good weather. But I think it's going to hold probably through tomorrow night for the block party. So what's up with the block party?
It's our last block party of the season. It's coming to an end. We've got to start moving into planning for the rest of our season events. Season 44 is coming up. The Arts Council has been planning events and cultural programming for 44 years, which is pretty impressive. But this block party is Alyssa Fisher Band. She's got a really cool quartet with herself, piano, guitar, and drums, or piano, bass, and drums. So that'll be fun. And then we're squeezing in a hula performance in between her two sets. So that'll be great.
All inside the Jack?
You know what? It's supposed to cloud over and chance of rain at 4 o'clock on Friday.
Of course.
Of course. It's been happening to us every week. So we are going to go with our usual setup in the main hall, but we open up all the doors. We open up the loading door. We put a speaker outside, and we make it really inviting, and it still feels nice and fresh.
And it's free, right?
It's free. It's totally free. It's open to the public. Families are welcome. There's a beer garden. There'll be a pet photo booth. So bring your furry friends down. We'll take photos of your pets.
That's
and we'll
popular.
Put them on. Yes, it's been really fun. And I have to say, I'm very proud of all the owners in Juno. They've been really good with their pets. And this will be a little bit more laid-back music, jazz, pop, Motown standards. So the pets should like it.
What else is going around?
We have ballroom dance following that directly after. So
lessons or...
There's no lesson this week. They do frequently have lessons by guest artists, but it's a great group of people that come in and decorate, and they DJ and dance for 3 hours, and there's a lot of like communal learning, I think, that happens. And then they give all the proceeds to help keep the Juno Arts and Culture Center running.
What time does ballroom dancing happen? The block party starts at 5.
Yep, 5 to 7, and then we'll clear the beer garden area, we'll load out everything they don't need, and the ballroom dance will be an immediate start at 7:30-ish.
And is that also open and free to the public?
It is. It's a pay-as-you-can event, so anything they get at the door, they give to the Arts Council, which is really nice.
And what's ahead in the coming week as well?
We have, on Saturday, of course, the Salmon Derby's going on.
Begins tomorrow.
Yes.
Yes, the silver salmon derby. Which will be fine.
There's lots of silvers out there. It'll be
good. Just fine.
There's a berry picking group at Fish Creek Road, which is really fun. That's from 10 to 12, and the Judo Audubon Society sponsors it. Brenda Wright, I think, is the lead there. They say wear your waterproof boots. It's open to the public and learn about berries in the area.
So that's up the Eagle Crest Road.
Correct.
Yeah.
And then there's Second Saturday Farmers Market from 10 to 3. That happens at the airport shopping mall, the area where Friends of the Library is. Mm-hmm. And that's open to the public. Lots of fun vendors.
And then I think there is some fresh produce that's showing up there.
Yep. I know Panhandle Produce will be there, and Orsi Organics is frequently there. There is a whole list online, Facebook, and we put posters up around town, too.
10 to 3 Saturday at the airport shopping mall.
Then, of course, Cambrillo at 2 o'clock. And then at 8 p.m. that night, we have a drag show called Fame. Miss Gigi Monroe presents Fame at the Rendezvous. So if you missed Glitz and you need a drag show fix, then this weekend.
9 o'clock?
Gigi is the best. 8 and 10 p.m. And I believe you can get tickets online on Facebook or check out the CELA website, perhaps, but Facebook's a sure bet.
8 and 10 at the Rondi on
Saturday
night.
And tickets at the door, I'm sure. Not a ton going on Saturday, except for some Sacred Harp singing at Trinity Episcopal Church.
Is that Saturday or Sunday?
That's Sunday.
Sunday is the Sacred Harp Yeah, I thought that sounded interesting that it said no singing experience needed.
Yep.
And it sounds like you can join in the harp being played and sing some hymns.
Yeah, they say they sing a cappella sacred songs. It's an easy method of learning and singing intervals. And the music is mostly 18th century. So if you're interested in singing and need a welcoming group, that sounds like a really fun thing to try.
And what time and the location?
2 to 3:30 p.m. at Holy Trinity Episcopal Church.
Okay, that's odd.
And it is also free. Yep. Monday, we launch into the regular what's going on in the weekdays. And the Arts Council is hosting a grantsmanship training program, which will actually start Monday. So you have a few more days to register. It's a week-long training program. It's 8:30 to 5:00. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
That's intensive.
It's an intensive course, but it's taught by the Grantsmanship Center, which is kind of the gold standard in grant training. So if you are interested in finding out how to write grants and going through the whole proposal process, it's a great, great opportunity.
Is there an enrollment fee for that?
There is an enrollment fee. It's a little bit spendier. It's around $900. However, if you are an Arts Council member group or part of a nonprofit in Juneau, we have a couple half scholarships available. So if you were balking at the price, then please give us a call. We'd really love to help other organizations.
Help you not bulk.
Yes, exactly.
Quite so much. Speaking of the Arts Council itself, the Arts Awards are coming up, are they not?
Yes.
When is that happening?
That's next Friday. So Friday, August 18th, 5:30 at the Jack. We have the Mayor's Awards for the Arts.
Do I get to twist your arm and we have some spoilers here? Or has it already been made public?
It's been made public.
Well, tell us who the Mayor's Awards are.
So we will be appreciating and honoring artist Frank Katass.
Wonderful. Playwright.
Arts education Maya Lager. Business leader for the arts, Betsy Sims, Studio A. Innovator in the arts, Tom Loker. Lifetime achievement, Mary Watson. Patron of the arts, Jim Barron. And achievement in the arts, James Hoagland. So congratulations. Thank you, Juno. Please, please come celebrate with us and these wonderful leaders in our arts community. Without them, we wouldn't be named a top small community for vibrancy in the arts.
And that's a week from Friday, 5:30 at the Jack.
We'll have a no-host bar and appetizers, live music.
It's a party.
It's a party. Following that will be our annual meeting. We need all Jack members there.
All right. Megan, thanks for joining us this afternoon in Arts Up. And tomorrow on a Juno afternoon, Andy Klein will host. You'll hear about Red Cross CPR training, Escape Alaska, and the Intensive Grants Workshop. Perfect segue. Thanks, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
Caballero, ay, acaba entrar Guatus. Ese mulato que mide 7 pies y pesa 169 libras. Y cuando ese mulato...
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220...